Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce to you the co-author of a book called Angels Don't Play This Harp, and that's with two A's, subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology. We're speaking with Dr. Nick Begich, and by the way, for those of you taking notes, his last name is B-E-G-I-C-H, who along with Gene Manning has co-authored this book, published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press. Dr. Begich, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Now, let's, begin at the beginning. Project HARP with two A's. What is it?
The program HARP actually is an acronym developed by the Navy and Air Force, and it stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. And this is a project operating here in Alaska, just about 250 miles northeast of Anchorage.
What does this project consist? You discussed in the book that it involves using so-called atmospheric heaters, basically radio antenna in phased array to radiate energy into the ionosphere in the upper atmosphere. How does that work for people that do not understand either radio or the physics of the ionosphere? Could you briefly explain how this is actually going to work?
Sure. What they've done is they've developed a system. It's actually a field of antennas, and they're about 70 feet high. At this particular time, there are 48 constructed antennas. And what they do is by energizing them with electrical energy, which is converted to radio frequency energy, it radiates from these antennas in what's called a phased array grid. So they fire them in series to cause the radio frequency energy to focus to a relatively small area in the ionosphere. And this is the first phase of a multi-level phase. This first phase will actually produce an effective radiated power of 1 billion watts, and then it's scheduled to go to 4 billion watts approximately in the second phase, and then an anticipated level eventually by the planners of 100 billion watts of effective radiated power.
So basically, these are radio antenna, which are going to be broadcasting energy into the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a critical element of the Earth's ecosystem and has profound implications for those creatures, human and otherwise, living on it. Can you briefly, Nick, explain to us what the ionosphere is, how it serves the Earth?
Sure. The ionosphere is an area. It's approximately 30 to 600 miles above the Earth's surface, and it's an energized area, and it acts more or less as a filter or a screen against incoming radiations that would be quite damaging. For instance, X-rays and cosmic rays are screened out in the ionosphere. And this is extremely important because when you compare it to, say, the ozone layer, which is screening out ultraviolet, which can cause skin cancers and severe sunburns, what we're talking about here is something much, much more important in terms of its environmental impact. This is a very critical area of our environment. It's also the area that radio signals are bounced off of to get the effect of radio over large areas. In this case, however, the radio frequency energy they're utilizing is for specific weapons applications.
We're going to talk about some of those specific projected applications in just a few minutes. The book is subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology. I realize this is a big subject, but Nikola Tesla, can you briefly tell us, for those members of the audience who are not familiar with that man and his work, who he was, what he worked on, and how the technologies involved in Project HARP are relevant to and developments of Tesla technology?
Sure. Tesla was quite brilliant inventor. In fact, in the 1880s, he was had developed the entire system of AC power generation and transmission. And that's what we operate in our households on today. In fact, people remember Edison as the pioneer in electrical energy and its uses for practical uses and application. However, Tesla's applications were much more readily utilized by the American world as a whole. In fact, that's what we use today. But he was also involved in advanced weapons research and other technologies, including beaming electrical energy from one part of the planet to another, which is sort of an overlap on the HARP program in one particular application. But when you look at HARP, what you find and what we found is 12 basic patents surrounding the technology. And within this patent cluster, the lead patents were by a gentleman by the name of Bernard Eastland. Dr. Eastland was actually, his whole creative stimulus behind the HARP transmitter was based on Tesla's original work and some of the theories of Tesla regarding weapons applications. Although the actual technology is probably quite different, the idea is essentially the same, creating in Eastland and Tesla's case a shield to protect the United States from weapon systems that might be engaged against us. And that's really where the root of this invention rests.
Basically using beamed energy in order to alter the atmosphere in such a way as to generate a number of different military applications. We're going to talk about some of those specific applications in a couple of minutes. The patents that you alluded to, by the way, Bernard Eastland's last name is E-A-S-T-L-U-N-D, is it not?
That's correct, and he's actually a really good guy. I mean, we've had a number of conversations, and just he's a very brilliant man, and a number of the applications that we uncovered were things that he just did not anticipate. But that's the way it is in science. People specialize, so they don't always see the big picture.
The patents that you alluded to, those 12 patents, have gone through a number of corporate sponsors or ownership. Three companies that figure prominently in the development of the HARP system are APTI, the mysterious E-Systems, and Raytheon. Could you briefly, Dr. Begich, explain these three companies, the relationship between them, and how they came to acquire and perhaps utilize these patents?
Sure. APTI was actually a first-line subsidiary of ARCO, Atlantic Richfield Company, which is the largest oil and gas company operating in Alaska, owning approximately half of the natural gas on the North Slope, which amounts to many trillions of cubic feet. Now, this natural gas currently has no market, so ARCO was going out to look for a way to develop those gas fields and actually find a way to use the energy in place. So they hired Bernard Eastland essentially to do that, to find a way to use this energy in some meaningful application. And what he came up with was the HARP transmitter for military application. Now, what became of that is ARCO began pursuing this whole area. They sold the military on the concept in the mid-'80s, and they formed a subsidiary, APTI, around Eastland. And Eastland actually ran the company in its formative years. In that period of time, ARCO advanced a series of patents going up into the early 1990s, where in which they developed the technology even further beyond what Eastland had originally envisioned, scaling down the power requirements for certain applications and so forth. What happened then is ARCO continued to develop, and they actually bid on this project against Raytheon Corporation initially and another bidder. And ARCO Power Technologies was reported to be only a $5 million a year company with no military contracting experience as a subsidiary of its mother company. Now, Raytheon, on the other hand, their competitor at that time, was a $10 billion a year company, one of the largest military contractors in the world, and they lost a $30 million initial contract to a company that didn't even post $5 million a year in sales. So this was, first of all, you know, quite anomalous in the sense of public contracting policy, but the only way that such contracts are gained are when one company has proprietary information or special information unique to it. In this case, it was these 12 patents which formed the base for what would become basic science for a ground-based Star Wars weapons technology, which is what and how we characterize the HARP program. What then happened is E-Systems, in June of 1994, bought out ARCO Power Technologies Incorporated, bought them out entirely, and the patents as well as the second phase contract on the project. Now, E-Systems is an interesting one. They made 60 Minutes a year or so ago, and they also made the front page of the Washington Post as one of the most secret companies in the United States, doing $2.1 billion a year in sales, of which $1.8 billion were for security agencies, military intelligence groups, CIA, and others. And of that, $800 million are black projects, projects so secret that even the United States Congress is unaware of what they are. Now the interesting twist, Raytheon then comes in, and they buy out E-Systems, lock, stock, and barrel. So here you have this big circle. You have Raytheon on the one hand, bidding and losing, and now in the end ending up gaining this basic technology and the patents. And the interesting part is Raytheon owns thousands of patents, so these 12 now disappear into their mix very difficult to extract where they came from or the chain of assignment unless they had been pulled prior to those transfers. And that's when we pulled the original files, and that's what our files indicate, was Arco Power Technologies was the root, and the end owner is Raytheon, now one of the most powerful military contractors in the world.
And this, again, via E-Systems, to a certain extent mysterious and certainly sub rosa slash covert military and military contractor with ties to the intelligence community. Now, with regard to the specific applications of Project HARP to various areas of military activity, one of the applications that you mention is missile detection, and in terms of determining the difference between dummy warheads and real warheads, and also defense against guided missile attack through altering the atmosphere in such a way as to neutralize those missiles. Can you explain how Project HARP is projected as doing this?
Sure. There's actually three patents surrounding that particular idea, along with an article that we found sort of after we published, but one showing that the former Soviet Union had developed a similar technology. But essentially what they can do is they can create an over-the-horizon radar effect. And what's interesting is this site where it's located, where HARP is currently built, is the old site of the backscatter radar station. And this particular station was abandoned theoretically after the Cold War ended. However, when you read the patents and you look at the technology, this technology was far superior to the old over-the-horizon technology that they had up to that point developed. This technology will look over the curvature of the Earth and detect incoming objects from ionospheric levels, which we had said earlier were quite high, several miles above the Earth, all the way down to the surface. So you're even able to detect, in this instance, cruise missiles. Now, what can also happen is by increasing the energy output of these devices, these radio frequency transmitters, it'll create a field around the incoming objects that then, using gamma ray detectors, they can actually determine which objects are carrying nuclear payloads and which ones are decoys. And this is important because in a nuclear threat cloud, which is the way they characterize an attack, we might have as many as, say, 100,000 incoming objects, which only a few will actually carry warheads. And the objective of having all those decoys is you figure some will get through. Well, with this technology, they would be able to discriminate between those that are decoys and those carrying nuclear warheads. And then by adding even more power into the antenna array and subsequently into the ionosphere bouncing back to the Earth, they're actually able to cause bit errors on the onboard computers, which causes them to malfunction and crash. So this is pretty versatile in those three particular applications. There are three patents surrounding that. All of them are now held by the company in control of this particular project. So it is, in a sense, a very sophisticated, not only detection device in this application, but also one that can actually destroy those incoming objects.
Can you briefly explain for the layperson, of whom I am one, how this phased antenna array will accomplish or is projected as accomplishing these tasks? In other words, what is the physical mechanism involved?
Okay, what they do is by firing these antenna in a specific way, they're able to create a focusing ability. And with that, they're able to then bounce using a smaller array, which there is one located here called High Pass up near Fairbanks. They're able to bounce the signal off of this artificial plasma layer, or this layer of energy that they're able to place in the upper atmosphere, and they're able to maneuver this like a mirror. It can be pictured as a hand mirror bouncing light, only in this case it's a energy mirror bouncing radio frequency energy over the horizon, and that's essentially the basic mechanism. It's a two-pronged or two array approach in that particular application.
Now, the term plasma, something you refer to frequently in your book, very briefly, for the layperson, that is?
Well, when you look at it in this application, it's cold plasma. It's actually got a low temperature in comparison to what most people think of in terms of high-energy plasmas. But what it essentially is it's by rapidly scanning and more or less painting in the ionosphere using this device, they're able to create what could be characterized as a wall of a standing wall of energy, if you will. That's, I think, the simplest way to characterize it.
Another of the applications that you discuss is something called deep earth tomography. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this is actually what is funded for this year. It goes in conjunction with the with another application that I'll mention briefly. It's the idea of creating an ELF, extremely low frequency. And what happens is the primary frequency of this device fires into the ionosphere and it pulses. And by pulsing the primary frequency, acting as more or less a carrier, what it does is it converts the ionosphere into a very large antenna. The ionosphere essentially is DC, or direct current, but by oscillating or causing it to vibrate in a specific way, it becomes more or less AC and acts as an antenna. Now, previously, they could create these kinds of effects using 14-mile-long and 28-mile-long antennas buried in the Earth or just traversing the surface of the Earth. In this case, they actually convert the ionosphere into that antenna, which then sends a secondary signal back to the Earth. It penetrates the Earth and sea and can be used for a number of purposes, one of them being communication with submarines, the other being Earth-penetrating tomography. And this is the idea of in the vernacular, X-raying the Earth or looking into the Earth for underground anomalies such as nuclear facilities, tunnels, oil and gas fields, and mineral deposits of various kinds. And this particular application is funded this year. It's the only thing funded under the defense budget for HAARP, and it's under the non-proliferation and counter-proliferation portion of the defense budget.
We should mention this project is now in a test phase. It's projected to be online in 1998. Is that correct?
Right. They're in their first phase of development, and there's always confusion about power levels regarding the project. And we've been in debates with the military on this, and they always want to talk about, you know, input power, or they want to talk about the first phase power, and they just don't really want to talk too much about what's coming up downstream, because that's where the real potential for risk is, as well as there's some nonlinear effects that we might have a chance to get to during the course of this hour that are quite important to the whole project.
This is a very broadly based, this system has a very broad applicability. We're going to talk about some of these applications. You used a term, Dr. Begich, pulsed. Again, for the layperson, can you briefly explain what that means and how it relates to this technology?
Okay, what they do is a frequency that, as I said, it's high frequency active auroral research project, but to create a low frequency for these certain applications, the high frequency acts as a carrier and they pulse it or cause it to vibrate at a pulse rate or lower vibration rate. In this case, it's vibrating between 1 and 20 hertz or cycles per second or pulses per second. And what happens in that particular range, this is a range that is used for communications and for the Earth-penetrating tomography application, and it also happens to be a range that correlates to predominant brainwave frequencies, which is something that we'll talk about as we go on today.
Again, one of those many applications. One of the applications you discuss is the possibility of creating nuclear-size explosions, but without nuclear material. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. This is sort of an aside to the whole patent package. They created a way to sort of skirt the nuclear weapons treaties. In this particular case, what they were looking for is a way to create a 1 megaton blast without necessarily using a nuclear detonation device or using natural gas. What's important in this regard is this technology also can be used, the HAARP system can be used, for creating an electromagnetic pulse. Now, this is what we used to get when we would detonate a thermonuclear weapon in the upper atmosphere. We would get this pulse that would come down and knock out electronics over a very large area, knock down power grids and communication systems. But it was messy, obviously. We had radioactive fallout and a lack of being able to control it. In this case, they can have a controlled EMP or electromagnetic pulse using the HAARP transmitters at high power densities, high power levels. And there is some indication that even at the lower levels, there may be, and there's strong evidence to show this, that there may be what's called a nonlinear effect, or where the HAARP instrument on the ground acts as a trigger mechanism for releasing vastly larger amounts of energy in the ionosphere. And what research has shown from Stanford University is that you can put energy in and it will actually amplify once it hits the upper portions of the ionosphere up to 1,000 times, which means that a billion watts of effective radiated power, if you could deliver it to the ionosphere at that particular point, it could magnify or increase or amplify that by up to 1,000 times. this is extremely important because it is these nonlinear effects when they hit specific window frequencies or windows of opportunity for this to occur. This is where we're particularly concerned that these nonlinear effects or this instrument acting as a trigger may, in fact, release vastly larger amounts of energy that become out of control.
We're going to talk about some of the possible unintended effects of Project HARP, almost as scary as, or perhaps even scarier than the intended effects. So in addition to utilizing some of the natural gas in the oil fields up there to generate nuclear-sized explosions, but without nuclear energy, HARP is also projected as generating EMP without a nuclear explosion, and that could be used for knocking out enemy communications.
Right, and this is, this is something that's quite interesting, and in the sense of how it might work. When you think about destroying communication, people go, then, well, how will they run their own? And that's actually spoken to in the patents. And because this device is capable of rapidly scanning a broad band of frequency, covering everything from ultra low to visible light, which is a huge portion of the spectrum, they can sweep this very quickly, and at the same time carry their own communications. So, in other words, on a very large scale, as they ramp this project up, they could knock out all communications and yet carry their own. And this is important, particularly when you consider that, when you talk about all communications, you're talking about ours as well as theirs. And I think that's an important issue for Americans to recognize.
One of the things that you discuss in your book, along with your co-author, is the history that our national security establishment has of experimenting with regard to weather control and the possibility, in fact, one of the projected applications of HARP, is to utilize weather control and the modification of weather for military purposes. Could you go into that a little further?
Sure. And in fact, this is an area where people kind of get glazed over in their eyes when they're looking at you and you're talking about it, because they go, you can't modify the weather. That's not possible. But in fact, it is. In fact, in 1976, the United States and over 60 other countries signed an accord wherein which we agreed to not use weather modification as a weapon of war. In other words, before many of the chemical treaties and weapons treaties on nuclear arms were signed, we were all signing off on weather modification treaties because the technology had advanced to the point where it was a significant threat to everyone. And nobody wanted that kind of experimentation or pushing on it in one place and seeing, what effects it might have in another. So that was signed almost 20 years ago. Now, since that time, there's been advances in the technology. We cite a number of these via footnote in the book. But basically what has happened in the course of time is the technology has advanced to the point where even the head of the United States military establishment is now talking about revisiting the idea of this agreement and perhaps reopening it for negotiations, because they feel like the need for this kind of technology is here now. Our concern is you cannot affect the weather in one place on the planet without potentially affecting it in many others. And again, this is either, whether it's intentioned or accidental, the fact of the matter is the technology speaks for itself, and we are very concerned that this may be one of the outcomes.
Reading briefly from Angels Don't Play This Harp, with regard to the history of weather experimentation and modification, you and your co-author write on page 77, quote, "The collective conscience was silent, however, and by 1995 the military has had another 18 years to work on weather warfare methods, which it euphemistically calls weather modification. For example, rainmaking technology was taken for a few test rides in Vietnam. The U.S. Department of Defense sampled lightning and hurricane manipulation studies in Project Skyfire and Project Storm Fury." By the way, I would interject that last one was the subject of some protests by other nations in the United Nations. And continuing, "And they looked at some complicated technologies that would give big effects. Lowell Ponte, P-O-N-T-E, author of The Cooling, says the military studied both lasers and chemicals, which they figured could damage the ozone layer over an enemy. Looking at ways to cause earthquakes as well as to detect them was part of the project codenamed Prime Argus decades ago. The money for that came from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA." So this type of Dr. Strangelove military applicability does have a well-documented history. Dr. Begich, in the last couple of minutes before we take a break, could you briefly explain again for the layperson how Project HARP and this phased antenna array is projected as altering the weather in terms of the physical mechanism?
Sure, a couple of ways. One of the ways envisioned and actually acknowledged by the program manager of HARP is if they get up to the higher power levels, the 100 billion watt range in terms of effective radiated power, they can actually lift a portion of the ionosphere approximately 250 miles in diameter and lift it approximately 60 to 70 miles high. In doing so, they create a void, if you will, where the lower atmosphere then rushes in, creating changes in wind patterns. That's one way that it can occur. The other way that we see that it might occur is by creating this wall of plasma and diverting jet streams so that they flow in a different direction, again, altering the natural flow of the weather patterns. And when we look at the Earth right now, today, what we all acknowledge is that weather patterns are demonstrating very chaotic behavior. We can also look at earthquakes, which is another way the Earth releases energy, increasing in frequency, depth, and magnitude. And this is all well-documented research. And the questions that we pose and the issues that we raise in the book is now we're about to add in a huge amount, an unprecedented amount of energy into an already disturbed and chaotic system. And it really may well be the straw on the camel's back. And that research is borne out by others. Specialists in geophysical warfare is what we're talking about. And it's not a new concept. It goes back to the 50s and 60s. One of the key proponents was J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson, who suggested that all of this was possible and that it only required the introduction of new technologies and instruments, which he felt were on the horizon in 69, and we suggest have arrived in 1996.
One of the things about Project HARP that is most alarming is, first of all, the deliberate destructive effects that are contemplated with these various applicabilities. And then, as you and Gene Manning point out, and as we're going to discuss at greater length later on in this interview, there are possible unforeseen side effects. You and your co-author describe some of the shot-in-the-dark aspects of Project HARP, that is to say, experimenting with technologies, the full implications of which are not understood, as you compare that with finding a sleeping bear and poking it in the butt with a sharp stick to see what happens. Which I guess for people in Alaska has particular meaning in light of the presence of those creatures up there.
You know, it is, and our concern is the U.S. government has a demonstrated history of taking huge risks. I mean, when you look back on the nuclear weapons programs of the 40s and 50s, people were subjected to exposures that the government now we find knew well then, as they do now, that they were dangerous and yet exposed our own citizens to those kinds of risks. Every month or two we hear another revelation about some disclosure of some abuse in terms of weapons technologies testing. I mean, the biggest polluter in the United States in terms of major cleanup areas is the United States military. The general regard for the environment in comparison to the development of technologies at all costs is certainly not well balanced. When you look at the CIA's work, in terms of using LSD on Americans, which is borne out in a 1975 presidential report. There are aspects of government intervention in a program called MK-Ultra, which was a mind control program initiated by the CIA covertly within the United States.
A name, by the way, well known to this listening audience. Go ahead.
Injection of radioactive iodine in Native Alaskans is currently a $470 million lawsuit by Native Alaskans. I mean, these are not new concepts. One of the projects they were going to do here in Alaska in the early 60s was a Project Chariot, which was the idea of detonating six thermonuclear weapons for the purpose of excavating a bay at Point Hope, Alaska. Fortunately, that was blocked by biological scientists and Native Alaskans. But, you know, I mean, today we think that's insane. It's totally crazy. Everyone knows that there's this undue risks and that kind of experimentation. And yet, the 60s, they knew it too, and yet they were encouraging it because they wanted to demonstrate this capability. And I believe that that's the same kind of thinking that is feeding the HARP program. Not so much by the technicians on the front end.
We're almost out of time on this cassette side. We're going to continue with this discussion on the other side. We're speaking with Dr. Nick Begich, who, along with Gene Manning, is the co-author of Angels Don't Play This HARP, Advances in Tesla Technology, softcover Earth Pulse Press. We'll be back with Dr. Begich in our next half-hour segment.